Welcome to Skin Deep. I'm Dr. Anna Chacon, and today we have a very special guest joining us. Get ready for some expert insights you won't want to miss. Let's dive right in.
We'll probably clip this. This is actually my first podcast. You know, I've started my own. I wanted it to be more about medicine and entrepreneurship and not just, you know, interviewing doctors, because I think there's a lot of things that you deal with as a doctor that people don't know about that are really hard. Like, I think some of the areas you specialize in, running a business like I do, is not talked about enough. And some of the obstacles that you just face. So I'm sure you have some interesting cases. First, what led you to focus on this area? Like, what made you decide you want to do this?
Well, the general practice of personal injury I got involved in because, I know in medicine, you're very familiar with being an intern and then a resident and kind of learning while still being in school for a little while. And, and law is similar in that typically as a lawyer, as a law student, you get a job after your second year, you're considered a summer associate.
Like an intern, sort of.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, and because let's face it, in law school, there's a lot of theory taught, and you become a summer associate working in a firm to learn how to apply that theory to the practice of law. So I ended up going to work for a personal injury firm that was handling at the very beginning of what's called a toxic tort case. Okay. And that is a case where 13 people, children, all had developed leukemia from living near a toxic landfill.
Wow. Where was the landfill?
In the Bronx.
Oh, wow.
So that's how I got started. And the firm I went to work with, they hired me after that summer. I started after my third year of law school. After I graduated law school, I started there. And their other part of their practice, other than personal injury, was medical malpractice. So that's how I ended up getting involved in medical malpractice. Not every personal injury lawyer handles medical malpractice.
Yeah. And I kind of try to stay away from these sorts of people. But what would you give for advice? You know, my practice in person is a year old. My own practice is about 3 years old. I did mostly telehealth first, and then I have like a hybrid in-person and telehealth practice. Telehealth was always considered kind of safe, you know, or kind of a little bit shielded from a lot of these cases. But yesterday I actually read in the paper that a family is suing Amazon's One Medical because a patient actually died right after a visit, was giving an inhaler and then just went to the ER and just straight up died, you know, and at the visit, virtual visit, just was given an inhaler. But what would you kind of recommend, your top recommendations to doctors so this doesn't happen to you, especially newer doctors that maybe are on their own, they don't have the backing of a big legal team like they do at hospitals like Cleveland Clinic. That's where I initially worked. What can you do to help yourself?
Well, first of all, you know, you have to, there's a few different things in the question. First off, anyone can bring a lawsuit. And in some states, it's not even required that you have any sort of
merit
sign off on merit to start a lawsuit. In New York, where I practice, after you file your lawsuit, you must submit a certificate of merit that shows that your case, you are attesting to the court that your case has been reviewed by a medical professional and that there is merit to it. That doesn't always mean that ultimately you're going to win the case, but there's reason to believe that there's a lawsuit here. That's what you're saying. And also remember, unlike, you know, an auto accident case, you know, I tell my clients who come to me with an auto accident, you're sitting at a stop sign and a person hits you in the rear. And after that, you know, your knee goes into the dashboard, you have a torn meniscus, you need surgery. I can tell that person the minute they call me that they have a lawsuit, because you know that there's liability there because they were sitting still when they were hit.
Yeah, they weren't doing anything.
They weren't doing anything. That's a lawsuit, guaranteed.
Yeah.
But every person who comes to me with a potential medical malpractice case, they are told that I can't tell you. First, I have an idea. I've been doing this a while. And, you know, I get paid on contingency. So as you can see from my face, I'm used to eating. So, you know, I usually get it right. But any malpractice case is not simply that something went wrong. That's not malpractice. Malpractice is a departure from good and acceptable medical practice. And you only get that by having another doctor say that this is a departure from good and acceptable medical practice. And in New York, at least, we can have doctors testify outside their specialty. In other jurisdictions, you're not allowed to do that. That you have, you like, if I'm suing a dermatologist, I would need a dermatologist to say this is outside the standard of care. And remember also, the standard of care depends on where you are. And by that, I mean the standard of care in New York City, in Miami, is different than the standard of care in a rural community in upstate New York. You know, it is different because it's a different standard of care, because it's a standard of care in the community at the time of the incident. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, so malpractice cases are really quite a different breed than a standard personal injury case. So, you know, again, the fact that someone brought a lawsuit, I can't speak to the merits of it. I just don't know. But it could just be that someone brought a lawsuit. Doesn't mean, you know, anything. The other thing you said is, you know, what about doctors who don't have, you know, kind of the army of legal advice that a big hospital has? Well, that's true and not true, in that every doctor is carrying malpractice insurance. And your malpractice insurance, if you read your policies, and, you know, I advise everyone always read your policy, but if you get a claim letter from a person, an attorney, who says, I'm investigating you, you notify your carrier right away. Your carrier right away assigns a risk assessment person and an attorney who's going to represent you. And the firms that represent you are almost always big firms. That's who does medical malpractice defense. So you do have an army, everybody. You know, I have encountered on rare occasion a doctor who doesn't have coverage, but that is generally not a thing. You know,
okay.
And also keep in mind, it also depends on your specialties. You know, I don't know if you're aware, but dermatological malpractice accounts for 1% of malpractice cases filed in the United States. It's very unlikely as a dermatologist to face a suit. The percentage of dermatologists who will be sued is about 13%, okay, over the course of their career. Compare that to OBGYNs, it's about 62% of them at some point are going to face a lawsuit. And surgeons, who only operate out of big hospitals, it's about 90% of surgeons at one time or another are going to be named in a lawsuit.
Wow. I didn't realize it was so high.
Well, but keep in mind, I've had surgical malpractice cases. What happens is there's generally someone I allege made an error. But there's three or four other doctors in that surgical suite. You must name them all, because you're going to need their testimony. It doesn't mean at the end of the day, they're still going to be in the case. And that's where that statistic comes from.
Oh, okay. All the people that are named.
I mean, anesthesiologists are named a lot because they're in the operating room.
They're just there.
They're there. But yeah, at the end of the day, they're not the target defendant.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. And then within dermatology, though, I'm curious, what is it that's, what's this percent? Is it mostly Mohs surgery? Surgery? Is it cosmetic? What is it skewed towards?
Well, I don't have an actual breakdown for where that, you know, 13% would be, but I could hazard a guess. As a general rule, it falls into two categories: inaction or an error in action. The the inaction cases are the fair to diagnose skin cancer cases. That's the most common. And to me, if you ask me, I would say almost all cases where a dermatologist is involved in a suit, it's a failure to diagnose skin cancer.
Failure to diagnose? Okay.
Yeah, that would be my guess. The other cases fall into the category of errors generally in like skin grafting after the removal of something. That's the, so that's where I say that's an action case as opposed to inaction, the failure to diagnose case.
What about this failure to diagnose? Because I know it's happened to me, but you ask someone to come back and they just don't, you know, you send automated reminders, you, you know, I always give patients a follow-up, you know, even if they really don't have anything to follow up with, it's as needed, you know. But I usually almost always give patients a follow-up because I think even if they come back and they have nothing, you're still documenting that they have nothing. You know, they came back, did a full skin check and it's all clear and we're good. Even once a year, you know, is a good time to have a skin check. But what if they just don't come back? They're kind of seething in anger and they approach, you know, a personal injury attorney like you. You've told them they should come back. You've documented that in your notes. You even have auto reminders that are sent, which I do with all my patients. And they just say, okay, failure to diagnose, you know, failure to this grew and, you know, all of that. Do you find that that's common or it's more the person who saw doctors, thought there was a problem and just nothing was done about it?
Okay, let's just to backtrack a little. Almost, I can tell you from my world, and my friends who do medical malpractice, I get asked or consulted on bringing a case far more than the number of cases I bring. So that means the person who you're describing, who went to see their dermatologist in December 2021, was told to keep coming back once a year and never went back. And then is diagnosed with cancer in December 2024. And they say, well, that first dermatologist missed it. That's not a case I'm even investigating. I mean, it's just not, because it's not, I can tell you from the medicine, it's not true. You know, it wasn't, it didn't exist in 2021.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, so that's part of it. But remember, again, people can bring lawsuits. And in some jurisdictions, you don't need even that certificate of merit. But just because they bring a lawsuit doesn't mean that it's successful. And in the case you described where, you know, you told somebody or somebody was told you have to come back, you come back once a year. My own dermatologist, after my last visit, told me, come back next year. Said, yeah, year after year. There was nothing suspicious.
Right.
He examined everything. Yeah. You know, he said, there's nothing suspicious. And come back in a year. So I don't think that's uncommon for someone who has nothing to wait a year. And you know, especially here in the Northeast, it's not like you're down south, right?
Miami, Florida.
Well, that's what I thought. Yeah. So let's face it, you know, it's a much different environment in terms of exposure to the sun where you are than where I am.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you know, in a case that you described, I suspect your attorneys who are going to be told right away that this is what it's about, they're going to get your records right away. They're going to see all the time reminders you sent. They're going to call the plaintiff's lawyer and they're going to say, look, You have no case. You know, your person didn't come. We, at least in New York, we don't have, we have comparative negligence. So a plaintiff who does things incorrectly is comparatively negligent. And if there is an award against the defendant, it is reduced by that plaintiff's comparative negligence. So the jury is told there can only be 100%. So how much percentage is the defendant responsible for? How much is the plaintiff responsible for? So let's say there's an, you know, the plaintiff is 80% responsible because they didn't return for their visits the way they were supposed to. And the doctor is 20% responsible because they did miss something. And there's an award of $100,000 for the plaintiff. That award is reduced by 80%. So the actual award is $20,000. You know, so we do have the concept, but the case you describe, because of the way skin cancer develops generally,
yeah,
if it wasn't there and then the person just didn't come back and 2 years later they say, oh, you missed it, the odds are you did not.
Okay. Yeah. That's, I actually was approached one time in the Virgin Islands. I was traveling and, it was a patient had seen me in a hotel, heard there was a Cleveland Clinic dermatologist there and said she almost lost her eye because some dermatologist missed it at Cleveland Clinic 5 years ago, something just like that. You know, about one of my colleagues, and I, you know, I told my colleague about it. I said, you know, you don't even have to tell me. I'm sure you gave her a follow up, and she just didn't come back. You know, and yeah, it just is. But I'm glad to hear that. So the certificate of merit, what do you need for it?
You need to. You are swearing to the court that a doctor has reviewed your case and believes that there was a departure in good practice, and you know. That doctor who reviewed it may not ultimately be the expert you're using, but it could be, you know, a different medical professional. And we don't have to disclose who that is in New York. You just have to, you know, affirm to it to the court. And I can tell you as an attorney, it is truly bad practice to lie to the court. So hopefully nobody's doing that. But, you know, in my own cases, before I start a lawsuit, I have, you know, again, because we work on a contingency model and medical malpractice cases are among the more expensive cases to bring through the court system. The you know, it's just an expensive process. Getting the records is an expense. Often they're voluminous. I have a case now where I just got medical records. The records are 1,100 pages, you know. So just to review the case before I know there's a case, that was $850. Then the doctor who you have to retain to review the case, that costs $7,500. So before I even put pen to paper to type out a complaint, I've spent over $8,000. And, you know, that's what you do on every case. So it's an expensive proposition to bring the lawsuit. And so you're careful about the cases you bring.
And how do you get these experts like to help you? Like, how do you get an expert in dermatology? How do you get an expert in all these fields? Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, you know, and you might not like what I'm about to say, but it's not bad. It's just from the person, from the plaintiff's personal injury perspective, we refer to doctors as having the white coats of silence. One doctor doesn't like to testify against another doctor, especially in the same state. And so often you have to get doctors from different states to testify for plaintiffs. And that's especially true in certain fields. Neurosurgery, it's notoriously difficult to get an expert. They do not like testifying against each other.
And, yeah.
You know,
well, they could also have a complication one day and need each other. So that's, you know, one of
absolutely
the reasons.
Absolutely true.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's absolutely true. But, you know, so, you know, how do you get the experts? Well, sometimes I've been doing this a number of years, And I know some doctors who do testify for plaintiffs in different specialties. And so I've gone back to them for certain things. I had a very bad bed sore case where I felt the hospital, those are almost always hospital malpractice cases. And generally, they're not technically doctor cases, they're nursing cases. But
wound care nurses.
Right. Yeah. So, but you have to sue the hospital and the doctor who typically is referred to as the captain of the ship.
Medical director or something like that.
Right. And so I have an expert who I've used in the past, and I work with her now on many cases that involve, you know, decubitus ulcers, bed sores. So, and the same is true, you know, another area that's notoriously difficult to get an expert is orthopedics. You know, orthopods will tell you it's not like a puzzle when you break a bone. It doesn't always necessarily go right back into
together.
The same place.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, they give each other a wide range of latitude, especially, you know, in areas where there's so many bones, like a wrist fracture. So you have someone who I've been consulted on these cases. I turned it down, but, you know, a person who went in had a horrible wrist fracture. Okay. And, you know, there's many bones in the wrist. I'm sure you had to memorize the mnemonic.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Bones on the foot, bones on the hand. Yeah.
So, yeah. And so my client no longer had a full range of motion, and that, and you know, this, you know, and that's what the complaint was. And, you know, I did call an orthopod who I worked with in the past, and we're friendly. He didn't even charge me for the consultation. And we went through the notes, and I had the films. And he just said, Mitchell, look, you know, it's to some degree, it's an imperfect science. But the doctor did the best they could. The person still has, you know, 85% range of motion. And it was a horrible fracture.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. So I myself, as a child, had a horrible fracture in my arm, and you know, technology was different then. I mean, I'm not saying I was with the dinosaur, but we, you know, technology was different, and so I don't have full range of motion in one of my arms from the fracture, even though I think the doctor did a great job putting it back together.
Yeah, yeah, and then the last thing, because I know you have to go, but. I once heard, and maybe it was like many years ago in medical school, that if you're nice, like if you're just have a good relationship with the patient and the people around you, you'll just be less likely to be sued, you know. And that's actually my malpractice, which I use AON, you know, AON. Yeah, the vice president told me the same thing. She's like, you know, we had a case one day, we called the doctor and he was like a total jerk. And I just told him, you know, that no wonder you're getting sued, all these other things. But do you believe that? Or is that kind of like a myth?
No, it's 100% true. I mean, okay. There's no doubt in my mind that that's true. That, you know, your rapport with your patients is key. In Massachusetts, I think it was Mass General, or it might have been Brigham Women's Hospital. I don't remember. But they tried a study, and they, when the doctors made errors, and it does happen, the doctor apologized to the patient for the error and admitted what had occurred and admitted the error. Now, they had law in place that couldn't figure into a lawsuit if there was one. Okay, it was shielded from that. So it couldn't be used as evidence. What they discovered was the number of times that patients sued was reduced greatly, because arrogance is a killer for doctors with regards to patients. I mean, I mean that in terms of if things aren't going right and the doctor is really arrogant about it all, they're going to be sued. And B, the jury's not going to like them either, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, and so I think, look, it's like any service job.
Right.
You know, I have to get along with my clients. You have to get along with your patients. You have to listen to them. Yeah. You know, you have to be empathetic to them. And I think if you're not, and then something bad happens, then yes, I think there's more likely a chance you're going to get sued. Whereas, you know, if you have a great rapport with the, I've heard from many people, and it happened recently, actually, where I really do believe that there's a case there that the doctor really did depart, and it caused significant problems for the person. And so I've only been talking to the wife, because the husband's the one who's still going through all the problems. And the wife said to me, I don't know if he'll sue the doctor because he just likes him so much. So, you know, it's definitely true.
Wow. And then two last questions. These are just approaches that I've taken over time. How important are notes? And then how important is one thing I've got into the habit of doing is I always have, I never see someone by myself. If it's a virtual visit, I have a virtual medical assistant. If it's an in-person visit, I have an in-person medical assistant. I just think it's, you know, they help in other ways. They help with note taking, they help facilitate the visit, but also they help make sure that, you know, if there's ever an issue, you know, there's another person that was there, you know?
Well, I think in the modern world, it is very important to have another person there or a person sitting right outside with the door open. I think that's very important in the modern world for every encounter. I do it with my own clients. I think it's equally important for doctors, especially in situations like yours, where to do a proper exam, often the person must disrobe.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think it's very important they have somebody else there who can attest to and testify to, if need be, really what happened. Notes, also equally important. I think you have to document the interactions. I think it's a good idea. I mean, I know in the old days, and you still see it from time to time, you doctors are notorious for having horrible handwriting. Just horrible. But yeah. In the modern world, you're almost all typing it into some sort of program. And so the notes have become quite a bit easier to read. But I think it's very important to document what occurred, especially if it was something was done at the visit against your advice. Then I think you better make sure that's in your notes. You know, you're seeing a person repeatedly. The person has had some, you know, minor skins. You've had to, you know, do some minor things to remove certain marks on their face or whatever. And you tell said person, look, you know, you're at a high risk category. You have, you're very fair skinned and living here, you should be going out with no less than SPF, you know, 50 on. And at the visit, the person says to you, doc, I use baby oil. Well, you know, that should end up in your notes because that down the road is totally counter to everything you've said, and it occurred, and you better have a note for that so that it's not just, because if you don't have the note, down the road, if something happens, you'll say, oh, they told me they use baby oil, and the attorney for the plaintiff is going to be like, well, that's a very convenient thing to say because that's horrible, but it's nowhere in your notes. So, you know, make the notes so that you, you know, you have the backing that you need. We, you know, I just think documentation is crucial for the medical field.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. I got to go, but
okay, Doc.
But thank you.
As I said,
on a Saturday for me. Thanks.
You're going out in the sun. I really have snow here. So,
okay. All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.